I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday afternoon. The Mediterranean has become a migrant's graveyard. The latest boat to sink went down on Saturday night, 130 miles off the Italian coast, or island, rather, of Lampedusa, and 17 miles from the Libyan coast. So far, only 24 bodies have been retrieved, and as you heard during the newscast from NPR, there are beliefs that some 750 people may have died. On April 12, some 400 migrants were feared drowned after their vessel capsized off Libya. In February of 2015, at least 300 migrants feared drowned as four dinghies got into trouble after leaving the Libyan coast in very bad weather. In October of 2013, more than 360 people, mostly Eritreans and Somalis, died as their boat sank off Lampedusa. And in September of 2014, at least 300 migrants drowned off Malta when smugglers rammed a boat after its occupants refused to move to a smaller boat. Today, European leaders are addressing the issue of the huge flow of refugees fleeing the disintegration of Syria and Libya, or they're coming from Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Mali, various places in Africa. And this hour of the program, we're going to be talking about this human tragedy, Europe not knowing where to put people, turning people away, not having a policy as to what to do with all these people or what to do with the boats. And we have two guests with us during the course of this hour to discuss the terrible situation, and we'll be welcoming phone calls as well. Daniel Trilling will be joining us for a portion of the hour. Daniel is editor of New Humanist magazine. He reports on refugees at Europe's borders. He's a former editor of The New Statesman and is also the author of Bloody Nasty People, The Rise of Britain's Far Right. He wrote a very moving piece about a refugee who left from Libya 4 years ago and the harrowing experience of being on one of those boats. Daniel, we thank you very much for being with us. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and thanks very much for inviting me onto your program.
Yes, our pleasure. Also joining us is Behzad Yagman. He's a professor of political economy at Ramapo College in New Jersey. He's taught in the U.S., in Iran, and Turkey. He's the author of Social Change in Iran, an eyewitness account of dissent, defiance, and movements for rights, written after a year-long visit to that country. He was a columnist for a popular reformist newspaper. He traveled the Middle East and Europe for 2 years, starting in 2010, following migrants from Muslim countries on the journey to the West, listening to their hopes, dreams, and fears. And those stories are in his book, Embracing the Infidel, Stories of Muslim Migrants on the Journey West. He's also the author of several other books. Professor Yagman, thank you very much for being with us as well.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, Daniel. You told the story that appeared just this week of someone who made this journey some 4 years ago and the horrors of being on a boat like that and luckily making it to shore. But it was a real personal account of what so many people, if they're lucky to make the journey, experience.
Yes, that's right. So the person whose story I told was a young man called Hakim. I think he's around 30 years old now, and he originally came from Nigeria. But in fact, he wasn't somebody who had ever intended to come to Europe. He was living in Libya and had been there for about 5 years. And he had gone there to find work, and he had what he as he described to me, was a fairly well-paying, stable job as a tailor. He said he made clothes for women. He lived in a city in the south of the country. But after the civil war that broke out in 2011 during the Arab uprisings, the situation there became very difficult for black African people who were living in Libya, partly because of the general security situation. As he described it to me, there were, every time you went out of the house, there were armed gangs, and they'd ask you if you supported them, and you didn't know if they were allied to the Gaddafi regime or to the rebels. But I think there was also a quite high level of racist violence being committed against people from sub-Saharan Africa there. So in 2011, a month or so after the fighting started, he decided he had to get out, And some friends told him that if he went to Tripoli, he'd be able to find somebody who would help him get onto the boat. The way he described it to me at the time, he had next to no idea of how dangerous it was going to be. He said to me he'd only ever been on a boat once before in his life, and he can't swim, so he really didn't know what he was getting into.
And you wrote a piece, I believe, in October of 2011. You've written quite a bit since then, Behzad Yaghman, saying this: we are facing a looming humanitarian crisis. An equitable system of global burden sharing could help minimize the scope of the crisis. Well, this has been a crisis. When I read about the death toll from these trips on the Mediterranean for quite some time, it's just getting to be more and more of a crisis. Why has it not been addressed before now?
Yes, that's quite right. I mean, the flows of migrants coming across the Mediterranean or via other routes into Europe is not new. What's newer is that the numbers have risen as they've been pushed by conflicts in various parts of the world. So I think last year the largest groups by nationality of people that were crossing the Mediterranean were from Syria and from Eritrea. The reason it's become such a crisis, I mean, at least this is how it appears to me, having traveled to many of the different border areas of Europe and kind of tried to examine the problem for a while, is that it's a crisis partly of Europe's own making, because Europe's border policies have tended towards criminalizing migration and seeing undocumented migrants and refugees as a threat that are there to be repulsed. And accordingly, many of the systems that are in place at Europe's borders focus on either defence, so there are large fences, or now there's even a European operation in the Mediterranean that uses drones and other kinds of surveillance technology to monitor for threats. And the result is that the focus has really been on that and not on looking out for people who are in great need of protection. And they've also, European states have systematically closed off safer legal routes for refugees to come and claim asylum in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Behzad Yaghman, you wrote a piece about the Dublin II Agreement, I believe it's called, assigning the first country of entry into the EU the responsibility of processing asylum seekers' application. Is that where things stand now? I know leaders of European Union nations are meeting today. Are they going to come up with some other kind of plan here so more people can be rescued?
Well,
can you hear me? Behzad, this is
yes,
for you.
Yes, I can, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. The Dublin II Agreement practically is being ignored by most of the EU countries, particularly because a lot of the migrants enter Greece because Greece is one of the frontier countries, and Greece has had a history of practically not accepting anyone and not giving asylum to anyone. So most of the people who come to Greece get fingerprinted in Greece, and after a while they have to leave Greece and go to other European countries. And since they are fingerprinted in Greece, they have to be sent back. But since the numbers are so high and the European countries know of the situation of Greece, they're basically ignoring that. So Dublin II is really a thing of the past, and the European Union is trying to find a way to have an internal situation of equitable burden sharing between other countries and the frontier countries like Greece, Italy. And whatever they come up with, that would be something between them that would not solve the crisis. It would only better distribute the burden of the crisis among the 28 EU countries. But the crisis would remain. Mm. And the reason for the crisis itself is that we have multiple other crises that have intersection to produce the humanitarian problem that we are facing now. On one hand, the international protection regime is really archaic. It doesn't work. It was created in 1951 in response to World War II and the population movement that was created after World War II. That's the 1951 Refugee Convention. It only gives protection or assumes people deserve protection if they are persecuted by their government, or they have a fear of persecution by their governments based on race, religion, nationality, membership in political organizations, or political opinions. Since 1951, we have had numerous other forms of migration. People have been leaving their homes because of violence and poverty created by violence, because of conflicts, because of war, because of gender issues, because of cultural deficiencies. In a sense, people leave because of perceived or real notions of security gaps. None of these are covered by the convention. So that is millions of people on the road. The people who are in Libya waiting to go to Europe are not covered by the convention. That is, even if the European Union tries to address their plight, there is no criteria for accepting them and giving them protection. For that reason, the EU just recently announced that only 5,000 people will be resettled. We have more than 200,000 people in these different countries waiting to actually take the boats.
Yeah. And Daniel, is there some concern, and would it be a legitimate concern among European nations because they've had to deal with threats of terrorism, that some of these people in their minds might be potential terrorists and so they can't admit them? Is that a concern or is that not?
Well, I mean, I think it's a concern that has been massively exaggerated, really. Mm-hmm. I think, take Britain, for example, given that Britain has already got an issue with people who are British citizens wanting to go off and, fight for the Islamic State in Syria, it's hardly as if it's people from outside the country that exclusively might pose a threat. And in both cases, it's a tiny proportion of, the overall British population, and the vast majority of migrants that are coming across the Mediterranean or refugees trying to come into Europe from elsewhere are seeking safety from that very threat itself. And I think dealing with that should be the priority. I think it's also worth pointing out that what the other kind of concern is very often raised in Europe. So this will be what politicians will try to articulate, but many people in Britain might say this when they're asked about the refugee crisis is, well, it's all very unfortunate, but what can we do? The country's full. We can't cope with everybody. We can't take all of the world's problems onto our shoulders. We can't deal with millions and millions of people coming here to Europe because it's a safer, more wealthy place. And I think it's really worth reinforcing in light of that the vast majority of refugees in the world today are hosted in developing countries. I think something like 86% of the world's refugees are in developing countries, and it's only a minority who are actually hosted by all the rich parts of the world put together, so not just Europe, but North America, Australia as well.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting, I was reading about the law of the sea this morning, Professor, and it's interesting that sea captains and masters of ships in the Mediterranean have as their abiding value to rescue people who are at sea, and they've run into problems. I mean, the law of the sea and the law of the land seems to be quite different dealing with all of these migrants, doesn't it?
Yes, because if they try to save migrants, they will be accused of assisting trafficking of people. And that's one of the problems that many of the private citizens that try to save migrants at the risk of drowning have actually had. And this has led to a really more draconian measure by the European Union that was announced 2 days ago on Monday, 3 days ago, that now the European Union is going to go after the ships of what they call human traffickers. These are not really traffickers, they're smugglers. There's a major difference between trafficking and smuggling. So they're going to go after the smugglers, or traffickers as they call them, and their ships, assuming that if the ships are destroyed, if the smugglers in Libya don't exist, there would be no flow of migrants to the European Union. That is such a false understanding of the causes of migration. It misplaces the reasons, and it leads to migrants taking even more dangerous routes to come to the European Union. I followed migrants and refugees of different types for 3 years, people from Africa and the Middle East, hundreds of them. And at that time, they were not actually taking on big boats from Libya, because Libya was then run by a dictator. It was not yet a failed state. They were taking small inflatables, little flimsy fishing boats, and they're all overcrowded, and many would die on the way. Mm. So what we're going to do now is the big boats that catch the attention of the media will be gone, so migrants will come with the small boats, and mm-hmm. they'll die, and nobody will notice them. The day that the European Union countries met on Monday, this very same morning, a ship off the coast of Rhodes in Greece capsized. Three people died. One of them was a small child. Her story and her death went unnoticed. She lived invisible and she died invisible because small numbers do not catch our attention. Mm-hmm. So this is what's going to happen. Death is going to continue, but we're not going to notice them.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, now that this has been all over the newspaper in the United States and in other countries in the world, these hundreds and hundreds of people who have died just last Saturday and the week before, it's come to our attention. What's the policy now? If you're on a boat in the Mediterranean right now that's coming from Libya and you're trying to get to an Italian island or you're trying to get to Greece, what will happen? Is there a policy or not?
Not quite. I mean, today European leaders met for a crisis summit to decide on a common policy. And while they've made noises about the need to save lives and have suggested that perhaps the search and rescue operations in the Mediterranean could be extended, the focus has really been on this idea that it's all because of the phenomenon of trafficking. And I think, as the professor rightly pointed out, this, you know, the fact that they're even using this word trafficking shows what an effort is being made to spin this as a problem of crime. Trafficking should mean people being taken somewhere against their will. What's happening is people, smugglers, are helping people onto boats who want to get to Europe. I think what's likely to happen is that we'll see the existing border patrol operation given a few more resources, and it will perhaps have a wider remit to save the lives of people who get into trouble in the sea. But if you compare the area that the Italian Navy's Mare Nostrum operation was covering, that was the search and rescue operation that ran for most of last year, with the area that the EU's own border patrol operation Triton covers. Triton covers a smaller area of the Mediterranean. Really, it's just some thin strips around the southern coastlines of Italy and some of the other islands in the Mediterranean. So what's going to happen is that huge parts of that area of the central Mediterranean are going to remain unpatrolled by a dedicated search and rescue operation. What will happen instead, it will be left up to passing commercial ships to rescue boats when they spot them, and these commercial ships don't have the training or resources to do it safely. So the really devastating boat sinking that happened the other week, where over 700 people died, that boat was actually in the process of being rescued by a commercial ship, and it was because the boat capsized during the rescue attempt that so many people drowned.
Mm. We're going to welcome phone calls. Our number for you to join this conversation, we're talking about what has been called the Mediterranean being the migrants' graveyard, the hundreds and hundreds of people who have died trying to get to Europe from war-torn areas, from extreme poverty, Europe not seeming to have much of a plan in place to rescue people, and so people are dying at sea, and the stories you are aware of, I'm sure, of how they get on the boats and what the boats are like and the places where they're waiting to get on the boats and being beaten and some people being forced to be really slaves while they're on the boats or before they get on the boats and the amount of money they have to pay. It is such a sad, sad story. And so what are the answers to this? What do you think? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. Daniel is just with us for a couple more minutes, so if you want to direct comments to him, please do so immediately. He is editor of New Humanist magazine, reports on refugees at Europe's borders, and is a former editor of The New Statesman, author of The Bloody Nasty People, The Rise of Britain's Far Right. Also, Behzad Yagman is joining us. He is a professor of political economy at Ramapo College in New Jersey, and he has spent years covering the plight of refugees from this part of the world. So we welcome your phone calls. We'll take them momentarily. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll take one phone call for Daniel. He'll have to be leaving us. Bezod Yagman will stay with us for the full hour. And our first caller is Helen in Lakewood. Hi, Helen.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, please.
I'm wondering why there is no focus on making things better where the people are coming from. That seems to me to be a smart thing. Instead of everybody pushing them out of their backyard, why isn't there a focus on helping to make things better where they're coming from?
Daniel, you want to give a response, and then I know you have to leave.
Yes, very happy to. I think that's an incredibly important question, and it's something that actually, certainly in Britain, because the British government's position has been that it didn't want to support any search and rescue operation in the Mediterranean, because it said that would merely encourage more people to try and take the journey, which was a very, very hollow form of reasoning. And what they did instead was say, oh, well, we shouldn't be doing that. Instead, we should be working on long-term solutions to stabilize these countries that are producing large numbers of migrants and refugees. It's just a question of what. I mean, you know, we've mentioned Libya before. Now, the collapse of Libya is one key reason why so many people are crossing the Mediterranean at the moment, not just because they're able to get to the coastline and get into the boats, but because many, many people who are living in Libya are now fleeing because it's too dangerous. Well, Britain, along with other NATO members, took part in the airstrikes that helped unseat Colonel Gaddafi in 2011. And Britain's Prime Minister, David Cameron, was very happy to declare that mission accomplished. And hasn't really wanted to talk about what's happened in Libya since the NATO operations finished. Britain is very reluctant to make a sincere effort to help stabilize that country. I think also, you know, there's been a huge failure of foreign policy in Syria, and that war has just got worse and worse as it mm-hmm. has dragged along. And I also think, you know, there needs to be real political effort among European nations to address the unequal and exploitative relationships that Europe has with countries in the developing world, where, you know, we historically have amassed large amounts of wealth and left those countries in very difficult circumstances. I, you know, long term, these are all things that need to be looked at too.
Yeah, thank you very much, Daniel, for the call. And let's move to Syria for a little bit longer period of time. Bezod Yagman, you write that, and you wrote this over a year and a half ago, the continuing civil war and the grotesque violence by Syrian government forces as well as the rebels have heightened the world's concerns about the future of Syria and its people. It's sort of hard to imagine how we're going to make Syria a place, what anybody can do. Maybe there are some answers where people want to stay rather than get out of as soon as they can.
Well, I think the situation of Syria is out of control at this point. The refugee crisis in Syria, or from Syria, has gone through different phases. The first phase was when the regime was bombing its own cities. People fled the country, and they went, of course, to the neighboring states. Many became internally displaced. After that, infighting began between those who were fighting the regime. More people left because of the infighting among the rebels. And the third phase has been ever since the Islamic State began encroaching into different areas of Syria, yet we have seen more people leaving. So as a result, you now have half of the population of Syria displaced, 6 million in the country, nearly 4 million outside of the country, mainly in Turkey, in Jordan, and in Lebanon. What can be done? So you have 4 million Syrians outside of the country, and the 6 million who are there and displaced would like to go, but they cannot because they don't have the means to leave the country. And this is more or less a situation to which there is no immediate answer. Bringing political stability to Syria is not, even if all best efforts are made, is not going to happen in the near future. And it's going to be a prolonged war, which is going to produce more refugees. So the question now becomes, what do we do with the refugees who have already been produced, displacement that has already been produced? The way the international regime of protection is proceeding, and with the unwillingness of the West to accept more and more refugees, there's basically no way to help the population. And what we're going to see is that increasingly more and more of the Syrians that are now in Turkey or Jordan or Lebanon will come up with some money and end up somewhere closer to the European Union, either on the coastal areas of Turkey trying to reach Greece or even further on in Morocco or in Libya. So more people from Syria will take the sea in order to reach the European Union, regardless of what happens. So we need to have a collective measure, a collective effort on the part of many countries in the world to take on the question of the Syrian refugee crisis. It's not only the EU problem, it's a world problem. Really, at this point, the United States, Canada, Japan, Australia could fakely stand on moral high grounds because they did not face the death of 900 people close to their borders. It was the European Union. And of course, our gaze is on the European Union and its inability to save those who are trying to reach there. But I think it is also the common responsibility of the other countries I mentioned, the wealthy countries in the world, to increase their resettlement of not only Syrian refugees, but other refugees. Yesterday, the United Nations said we need to have 1 million Syrian refugees resettled in the next 5 years in the European Union and a host of other rich countries. If each country accepts 14,000 persons a year, we'll be able to take care of this. These are the things that need to be done. The world needs to open up its arms to accept more of these refugees that have been displaced partly because of the actions of the countries that are now bystanding and watching. Daniel was perfectly right when he talked about the NATO contributing, actually leading to the demise of the dictatorship in Libya and leading to Libya to become a failed state, a hub, a major migration hub. Now we're looking at Libya, and the EU does not know what to do. But the EU contributed to the creation of the statelessness in Libya. So in most of these crises, the West, the rich countries, have played a direct or indirect role. If you take a look at the economic inequality between Africa and the rest of the world, and the economic problems many of the African countries have been facing, you cannot ignore the negative effect of economic policies, neoliberal policies, that have been forced upon African nations in the past 20 years, and the negative effects these policies have had on the livelihood of people, hence causing displacement of those people.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the response would be in the United States if the president or if Congress took up an emergency resolution and said, because of what's happening right now in the Mediterranean, we need to allow 50,000 of these migrants to come to the United States?
I mean, so far, the response of the United States has been far from adequate. The United States is the wealthiest nation in the world. It does have a large capacity in its labor market to absorb people. It doesn't suffer from economic bankruptcy like a country like Greece does. The United States can do much more. It has been, I have to admit, the United States has been a rather generous country in terms of accepting refugees, but that's far from enough now. The generosity has to increase much further. There is a need for a much larger resettlement of people to the United States. And so the moral obligation that the EU actually has, the United States also shares. It is the same obligation here. Is upon all of these countries to step in and increase the number of people that they accept. And they have to go beyond the existing protection regime. They have to accept people who may not classify as refugees. And many of the migrants that come from Africa are not refugees. They don't classify as refugees under the 1951 convention, but they do need protection. They do need a different form of protection. They're in need of help. They left because of poverty caused by economic policy, maybe. They left because of economic problems caused by conflict. The 1951 convention doesn't cover them, but they need help.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to look into that very seriously. And it's a collective effort. The United Nations must be leading that effort now.
I can't get this image out of my head the last hour or so of when you talk about those who have and those who haven't. I think of all the lavish cruise ships that are in the Mediterranean now, and people are dancing and wining and dining on fabulous food and stopping on islands for swimming. And I'm seeing this encounter between one of those cruise ships and one of those makeshift boats where people are about to die in the middle of the Mediterranean. It's so jarring to me.
It is. And the image that really captured me most and has been haunting me is the image of a tiny child, maybe less than 2 years old, being pulled out of the water. Mm. And no child deserves going through that. And this is a shame on all of us. We need to stop this from happening.
Yeah.
A child is born, deserves the right to grow up and become old.
Yeah.
They should not die and drown in the waters at age 2 or 3.
Nobody should be. So the question of the hour is, what does the world do in response? Very little, way too little, is what it appears to be the case right now. We welcome phone calls from you. Is this story haunting you as well? What should be the response of the world community? What should be the response of the United Nations? Are there legitimate concerns among European nations where these migrants are trying to get to, whatever those might be, that they can't accept these people? But people are drowning in the Mediterranean. Huge numbers of people are drowning, and there seems to be a lack of an effective policy in place. So what needs to happen? Do you have any thoughts on it? Call us. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Bezalel Yagman is our guest now, professor of political economy at Ramapo College in New Jersey. He has taught in this country, in Iran, and also in Turkey. He's author of Social Change in Iran, an eyewitness account of dissent, defiance, and movements for rights. He traveled the Middle East and Europe for 2 years following migrants from Muslim countries on their journeys to the West. He lived among them. He listened to their hopes, their dreams, their fears. And those stories are in his book, Embracing the Infidel, Stories of Muslim Migrants on the Journey West. We're welcoming your phone calls on this haunting and very tragic story that requires so much of a response that doesn't seem to be forthcoming. So feel free to call us and tell us what you think about it. More phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls and to Aaron in Madison. Hi, Aaron.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm so really grateful for the show being on today and for your advocacy on this issue. I'm feeling really moved by this conversation. I'm a grandson of a Holocaust survivor who came to America as a young refugee, and we've established ourselves as Americans over the last few generations, and I feel really grateful for America's role in welcoming us. But I also feel really saddened that America didn't act sooner. And didn't allow more ships in before the Holocaust happened, and a lot of our people lost their lives because of that. And I really share the perspective that I hope that America will be even more generous in allowing even more people to come as refugees.
And what should that be? What form should that take, Aaron? Allowing people to resettle in America, or giving more money to help them find jobs and find places to live in Europe?
Both. I think I agree with the perspective that I think this needs to be a shared responsibility, and the wealthiest nations have a responsibility, whether it's helping settle people in Europe or also helping people come to America. I think we often underestimate what we're capable of doing to support refugees.
Professor Yagman?
Yes, I totally agree, and I think the analogy is perfect. Acting late and therefore causing disaster and death. But in terms of what the United States and other countries can do, let's take a look at our next door, Canada. Canada has a very elaborate system of accepting migrants. They give points to migrants if they meet certain criteria. So they basically give visas, residence visas, to people who bring money to the country to start a business, or if they have expertise that are in need in Canada. And scores of people have been coming to Canada in the past 10, 15 years. Canada has become extremely multicultural. It's a thriving multicultural country, and people have a good time and good life in Canada. Why not the Canadians open up their borders to more unskilled workers? Because what they're doing is basically, it's fine, people get a chance to come live and work in Canada, but this is what we have typically called a brain drain. It deprives developing countries of the brains that spend so much money developing. So they come work in Canada, but then the same country closes its doors to like unskilled workers from other parts of the world. The United States has been doing exactly the same thing. If you remember 3 years ago, the migration bill that got stuck in the Congress, it passed one of the houses, not the other ones. If you take a look at that bill, you'll see that there are numerous measures put in there to attract skilled workers. No such a thing for unskilled workers.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we need to change our attitudes. If you're willing to accept people with expertise and skilled workers from third world countries, we must also be willing to accept more people who lack those skills from the same countries. This is just fair. It's a question of equitable distribution. Also, this is the age of globalization. We force countries to remove barriers to the movement of commodities and capital. But we built borders, walls, practical real walls, to stop people trying to come from those countries to our homes. And I think this type of hypocrisy has led to the humanitarian crisis, has contributed to that, that we are experiencing today. So that needs to change. If globalization means creating a global village in which commodities and capital can move, people should at least have the same worth. We should create the same momentum and freedom for people, at least partly.
Thank you, Aaron, for your call. George in Milwaukee, hello.
Hello.
Hi, George. Go right ahead, George.
Yes, I just want to quote you about the phrase you say about those cruise lines in the Mediterranean having nice way to live in, nice beaches, a nice food to eat. I am from the Caribbean, but part of Mexico. We have the same situation over there. For those cruise lines who's going to the Caribbean, using the beaches and having a 5-star hotels, and some of those people from the Caribbean crossing all over to taking the train to Mexico, all the way to Guatemala, back to the north of United States, thousands and thousands dying in the way.
Yes.
And they're trying to pass the border in the desert, and thousands dying the same way there too. And it seems to me like nobody paying attention to these people, except when they are people from Europe, they pay a lot of attention. They call immigrants. And for the Latinos coming in this country, they call us illegals. Something I don't understand about that.
Hmm. Professor?
I mean, that's very true. I mean, the type of growth inequalities that you're talking about is prevalent all over the world. You see that in the Mediterranean, you see that in the Caribbean, you see that in terms of the difference in the level of economic development and people's income between poor African countries and countries of Europe that are not so far away. And as long as these gaps, income gaps, security gaps exist, people are going to be moving. Because now in the age of globalization, as opposed to before, people have access to knowledge and information about life in other places. They know what perceived or real opportunities are in other places. And they know their own situation. They know how far behind they are. So they move. And many of them move despite the knowledge of the risks involved. People are not ignorant to the possibilities of dying in the Caribbean or dying in the Mediterranean or dying in the desert trying to cross the border from Mexico to the United States. They know that. Their families and friends have died, but they still come. They come because the security gap, whether it is income gap, whether it is political gap, cultural gap, social gap that they're facing is so huge that compels them to do that. And for as long as these gaps exist, the population movement will continue. And no matter how many walls we draw, whether the walls are real, like the border between the U.S. or Mexico, or it's virtual, we'll have boats protecting and patrolling the borders, the sea borders in the Mediterranean. The movement is going to continue. When we close one border, people find another border. When I was doing my migration work for nearly 3 years, I would see that when the Turkish and the Greek government close off the land border in northern Turkey, more people will move towards the southern part of Turkey to try to go to Greece through the Mediterranean. When Spain practically closed the Strait of Gibraltar by patrolling that and got the cooperation of the Moroccan government to stop the flow of people from the Strait of Gibraltar, the sub-Saharan Africans who were trapped in Morocco took on the Canary Islands. So once we close one border, another will open up. This saga will continue. We need to have a long-term solution to this.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, sooner or later, we're going to have another episode that will catch the attention of the world. And really, my worry is not, although 900 people dying at the same time is horrific, it is horrific, but my worry is that this will stop that, but we'll have 5 people dying today, 10 tomorrow, 6 next day, and cumulatively the number will be the same, but they'll go unnoticed because they're small. The media doesn't have any appetite for small numbers. We are so taken by big events.
Right.
That would be the tragedy.
Yeah. Well, you kind of lose faith, I'm afraid. Maybe you can restore my faith by telling me about a country that's done all of this right. George mentions what we've faced in the United States. And, you know, it took these young kids walking by themselves for, you know, over 1,000 miles to get to the United States because there was so much violence in the areas in Central America where they were living, to open our eyes. You know, they had to be young people, and then they were put in detention centers. And then we had this huge debate in this country about what are we going to do? What about deportation? People were screaming at people in buses who were trying to relocate with relatives, even in the United States. And Congress said, all right, we've got to deal with this, and nobody's done anything. And so you've got all these people still in detention centers, and you've got Europe having a meeting today saying, well, we got to do something. We don't want hundreds of people dying in the Mediterranean. We don't want hundreds of people dying in the desert, but we don't do anything about it. Even when faced finally with this horrendous humanitarian crisis, and it takes an event like hundreds of people dying in a boat or kids being sent to the border by themselves, then we pay attention, but it doesn't move forward. Does it? Is anybody?
No, because the world's capacity and willingness to accept people has declined.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the number of people on the move has increased, both for political reasons and for economic reasons. And the defeat, the catastrophic failure of Arab Spring actually increased the number of people on the move. It exacerbated the crisis that existed before that. So at this point, we need to actually move, really act instead of talking. But when you're talking about kids coming from Latin America, President Obama has not been a good president in terms of protecting migrants and their rights. More people during his presidency were deported than any other president in the United States. However, to his credit, he was the one who dared to call the children who come to the country alone, unaccompanied by their parents, as refugees, calling them forced migrants, escaping violence in the hands of the mafia, the cartels, the violent gangs, not the traditional refugees escaping persecution by the government, but a different type of refugee. And I think that type of transformation in our thinking is important. Once you call a group of people refugees, whatever type of refugees they are, then they deserve protection. Then you have to give them protection. It's a matter of time for the country that receives them to take them seriously.
Mm-hmm. George, thanks for the call. Rick in Richland Center, hi.
Hi. I'm going to go back to the lady that called in about fixing the problems in these countries. I think that's really where it needs to be. You know, the United Nations governments, we could go after Iran with this nuclear program like, you know, it's the end of times. But any country that's warring on another should get the same attention. If you want to back up further and get into the military-industrial complex, the people that make money on building these machines of destruction, those are the ones that are profiting by those who are naive or gullible that take these weapons and think you're going to accomplish something. It's a big machine. It's about money. And we're not talking about that. I think we could do that as a people in the world. We could do that. No, listen to your comments off the air.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Professor?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I agree. I mean, things need to be done. to stabilize other countries. Unfortunately, we've been doing the opposite. I mean, if you take a look at our history, or I don't mean the United States, the history of Western intervention in other countries, the effect has not been positive. The effect actually has led to more displacement. For example, indirectly, the U.S. intervention in Iraq has led to massive population movement and displacement, not only by the Iraqis, but later on in Syria. ISIS would not have been a reality had it not been because of the U.S. intervention in Iraq. So because of, and that is true, that's related to the military-industrial complex, the group in power in the United States at that time, were keen on benefiting from the destruction and instability in Iraq, and they did. They made billions of dollars. But as a result of that, we are paying the price now in the form of violence, in the form of mayhem, and also massive population movement and displacement. So that's a longer-term issue, and to which there appears to be no solution, actually, because there are too many countries that are affected negatively by global forces, political or economic, and also they're affected by their internal political problems. Not everything needs to be blamed on foreigners. There are a lot of internal problems in Africa, in the Middle East, problems that are endemic to the country themselves, and they are producing displacement. So we cannot expect the world to be able to fix those problems, but we can expect at this point, to make the right move and open up to accept a larger number of people to reduce the degree of the humanitarian crisis that we are facing now. And I think this is what the United Nations asked for yesterday, that the rich countries in the world should accept 1 million Syrians in 5 years, I think, if I'm not wrong. And we can do that. We can afford that. It is within our capabilities to do that.
Yeah. So which countries, are there any on earth who are saying, okay, we'll do that, we'll help?
Nobody will.
Nobody will.
I'm sorry that this is one of our last words here. The situation is not promising at all. Not at all.
Rick, thanks for the call. Kurt, Chippewa Falls, hi.
Thank you. I really appreciate the guest speaking the cold, hard truth as eloquently as he is. I had two questions. Maybe you've answered enough about my first question, possibly expanding on the neoliberal policies that the West has inflicted in Africa and the Middle East especially. And my second concern has to do there is a fear that with so many non-European, non-North American people coming into European or American society, that they may not become Europeans or Americans, but bring with them some of the values and attitudes and dysfunctionalities that from where they come from. There are, for instance, Muslim self-appointed leaders in Europe who are bragging about the fact that they will displace European secular quasi-Christian culture in another generation or two, and that creates all kinds of fear, resentment, and resistance on the part of many. So that's my those are my questions. Will they adapt?
Thanks, Kurt.
I want to address your second question because there's not enough time. It's an important concern. It's a very important concern. But, you know, my book, the reason I call that Embracing the Infidel, Stories of Muslim Migrants on Journey West, it was to show that the people who are coming from Muslim countries, far majority of them, are not coming to disturb the security or the culture of the infidels, quote-unquote, the countries that are receiving them. They're coming. They're escaping insecurity. They want a new home. They want to be good neighbors with the people in their new homes. And I did not meet, actually, I met only one person. For 3 years, I traveled all these countries. I met different people. There was only one person from Egypt that openly defended Osama bin Laden and gave a rant like what you were discussing by this self-proclaimed leader in Britain. But the rest of them were ordinary people who were escaping their own predicaments and insecurities and just wanted a new home. They wanted to be good neighbors in their new homes. So there is a problem. There are some who come and want to adhere to cultures and policies that are non-European, non-Western, but the West is changing. Europe is changing. The Europe that existed before, the white Europe, Judeo-Christian Europe, that went to Africa, colonized Africa, caused all sorts of problems and came back with no consequences, is changed now. Now you have Africans living in Europe. You have Muslims living in Europe. That Europe is gone. It's the thing of the past. The United States is totally different now.
Yes.
Not only the ex-slaves have the right, equal rights to everybody else, you have massive numbers of people from Latin America, from other parts of the world. The demographic of all of these Western countries are different. So we need to learn from one another. We need to learn to live in a way to minimize destructive differences and respect other differences that are actually improving the society.
Yes, and on that note, we must say goodbye. Thank you very, very much for being with us. Behzad Yagman, professor of political economy at Ramapo College in New Jersey. And thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this show and to Scotty for on-air production here in Milwaukee.